And now to another lesser-known story in American history. If you have an iPhone or a laptop or an Android or any other computer, actually, you can thank bourbon, as in the whiskey. One night in December of 1937, a physics professor from Iowa State College named John Vincent Atanasoff was stumped. He was trying to figure out how to solve big equations faster. So
he got in his car, which was a nice new car, and he drove east from Iowa State.
And while he was driving, he was thinking about an easier way to solve those big equations.
Iowa was dry at the time, and he saw a sign once he crossed the river into Illinois that indicated that he could get a drink. So he went in, and he sat down, and he ordered himself a drink.
A bourbon and soda, to be exact. And that's when the idea came to him, a machine that could solve equations, a computer. As the story goes, he sketched out his ideas on how to build it on the back of a napkin, and then he jumped in his car and drove home 70 miles back to Iowa.
Whether he actually wrote about him on a napkin, nobody knows. But they came to him so forcefully that he maybe didn't need to write about them on a napkin. He just went home and found himself a graduate student and put it together.
That's Jane Smiley. She wrote about this forgotten inventor in a new book. It's called The Man Who Invented the Computer, the biography of John Atanasoff, digital pioneer. Now, four ideas came to Atanasoff in that Illinois bar. And remember, this is 1937. So the first idea,
it would operate electronically.
The second,
it would use a binary enumeration, which is 0101101.
Third,
it would use a little thing called a capacitor, which is a little bit like a battery.
And finally,
the fourth principle was computing by counting rather than by measuring.
And within a few years, Atanasoff's bourbon-fueled idea became known as the Atanasoff Berry computer, the very first electronic computer. So why does hardly anyone know about John Atanasoff?
After the war, a man named John Mockley, who had visited Atanasoff, learned all about the computer and gone back to Philadelphia, where he was from, and commenced to invent a new computer called ENIAC using three of Atanasoff's principles, which he learned from Atanasoff. Then Mockley became known as the inventor of the computer. In the 1950s and 1960s, it became clear that maybe the ideas behind ENIAC were not original. And so a case was brought in the late 60s and decided in 1973 about who actually invented the computer. Unfortunately, the results of the case came out the day that the Watergate tapes came out, and whatever was going on with the computer was just lost in that.
But that case determined that he was the inventor of the computer.
Yes, it did.
John Atanasoff never saw a dime from his invention, though he got wealthy from his other work. And his story isn't unique among inventors. He was a genius. He invented a world-changing device. Someone appropriated those ideas, and he died in obscurity.
And that's, I think, the reason the computer has become so ubiquitous, because nobody owns or ever owned the ideas.
That's Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Jane Smiley. Her new book is called The Man Who Invented the Computer, the biography of John Atanasoff, digital pioneer. Now, one place where things are rarely agreeable, sane, or even okay is the internet, specifically in the anonymous comment threads you find on so many websites.
My name is Kevin Collier. I'm a writer based in Brooklyn.
Kevin Collier is interested in the type of people you find in those threads. He writes a feature for McSweeney's. That's a website founded by writer Dave Eggers. His feature is called Getting to Know an Internet Commenter. And what he does is assemble comments from a few particularly prolific commenters, and the result is a kind of character sketch of the internet's strangest voices. When I spoke with Kevin Collier in New York recently, he said the idea started with a thought he had after reading so many anonymous ramblings, and that idea was, who is this person?
I've long kind of read just kind of the mindless comments that follow an awful lot of websites. Kind of, I think, like how some people like watching reality TV or trashy TV. And I couldn't find a good venue for it until I eventually reached out to Dave Eggers. Dave said, well, you know, it actually would work well on our site.
You brought some commenters to share. Can you tell us about one and then read a few of his comments or her comments?
Sure. My favorite is a guy named Cesar Z on Yelp.com. I've noticed that in his many, many reviews on Yelp, he reveals an awful lot of himself. Here's his review of the Cal State Fullerton Library in Fullerton, California. The employees here never want to help you, and when they do, they don't know what they're doing. Plus, it's haunted. Haskett Branch Library in Anaheim. A small library, small compared to the main branch, but bigger than the Sunkist branch. But the reason to go there is this beautiful girl that works here that I fell in love with. Her name was Hazel, but she got fired. Now I never go. L.A. Donuts in Anaheim. I really love this place. I had the hugest crush on the daughter of the owner, and I would come in after class when I was in junior high. But the skate store next door opened up, and all the skaters got to her, and one of them got her pregnant. I never saw her again.
Who is he?
He's this guy. He falls in love with an awful lot of women in the Anaheim area. Women who work in the service industry. The good ones reveal themselves after a lot of looking to be, I don't think, an exact representation of what the person behind this is, but, you know, kind of a caricature of them. But they are kind of real characters.
Do you think that there's something coarse about the culture of comments on websites that actually has encouraged a coarseness in our culture?
I don't know if I would go quite that far. Sure, there are so many extremely coarse commenters out there, and it's easy to throw your hands up and despair. That's like, hey, this must be reflective of discourse in America. But, you know, like whenever a new one of these, whenever I post a new one up on the McSweeney's website, I'll get not a ton, but a few people will write me in and they just say, hey, this is funny. You know, like, I like this. And it's kind of a random act of kindness, you know. And here's another half. Here's an old guy from Iowa. He calls himself Trident 32. He's a retired pilot. His opinion on football is, this is all in caps and with exclamation points, on football. I call it throw ball since the foot is rarely used. And at one point he offered, in response to a recipe for hamburgers, I decided to travel down Route 66. This was before the interstate highways. I would buy some aluminum foil and a potato and an onion and a pound of hamburger. I would slice the potato.
That's writer Kevin Collier. You can follow him on Twitter at Kevin Collier. You can also read the entire profile of his favorite commenter at our website, npr.org. We're back with All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz.
We've gone through 18 hearings. We've answered 1,000 questions. We have met the concerns about modernizing our nuclear stockpile with concrete budget numbers. It's time for us to go ahead and get it done.
A frustrated President Obama speaking about the New START treaty at today's NATO summit in Lisbon. The nuclear treaty with Russia is currently stalled by Republicans in the Senate. James Fallows is national correspondent with The Atlantic. He joins us here most Saturdays. And Jim, just back from Australia, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Guy. Nice to talk to you again.
Jumping off that clip of the president, Jim, and thinking about this first week of the lame duck session in Congress, you know, where almost nothing of substance was accomplished. I'm wondering what you make of it. I mean, is it, in a sense, a strategy by the Republicans to sort of underline their view that President Obama has become weakened both domestically and internationally?
I think it is that. And I think there's a spectrum of opposition that's worth bearing in mind as we see the news unfold over the next couple of months and the next 2 years. You know, naturally, an opposition party is often in business to oppose an incumbent administration's policies. And of course, after a midterm election where the results change, it's always the case in these lame duck sessions that there's some forward projection of the results that have just occurred. But I think what's interesting here, or perhaps more worrisome than interesting, is a number of measures that the Republican opposition would otherwise support. It's now seeming to oppose mainly for the point of stymieing the administration. I think this the Russian so-called New START treaty is probably first in that list, where most of the retired and incumbent military leadership is in favor of this, and many Republicans have been too. And so in the interest of stopping the administration, a number of Republicans seem willing to stop something that in other circumstances, and certainly including a Republican administration, they would support.
As you remember, a few weeks ago, right before the midterm elections, the Senate Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, said that it was his goal to make President Obama a one-term president. That was his political priority. Do you think what we saw this past week in Congress foreshadows where we're headed when the new Congress arrives in January?
I think that's very likely the case. And again, it's a question of degree. Senator McConnell may have erred from his predecessors mainly in being more blunt, because often opposition leaders, you know, were trying to get a newly elected president from being elected again. But 2 years is a long time in the business of this nation. There are lots of things the country has to do in economic matters and security matters, you know, you name it. And if it seems to be the case that for the next 2 years in American government become mainly a way of positioning the two sides for the next presidential election, that is not really very good for the country. And also structurally, it means that more and more the administration will try to do the things that are strictly within executive purview and don't require legislation. That's not really a recipe for good government, but I think that's what we can expect.
Now, obviously, a lot of comparisons being made to 1994, the Republican Revolution, and then, of course, the Gingrich-led Congress and the government shutdowns. Is that where we're headed?
You know, I've been trying to think of the closest parallels to the situation we're in now, and I sort of resist the 94 Gingrich revolution just because it's almost too obvious. You have a newly elected, relatively popular Democratic president who then loses the House 2 years later, et cetera, et cetera. And there was the famous showdown between Speaker Gingrich in the House of Representatives and President Clinton in the White House about funding for the federal government as a whole. And this led to a freezing stalemate, which it was seen both politically and on substance the Democratic administration finally won. So I think that the Gingrich confrontation with Clinton was a novelty in modern politics, which we may see a repeat of now.
A novelty, you say, but maybe actually the template.
Yes, indeed. And so this is one more reason to watch with interest and I won't say apprehension, but with heightened interest, the political and substance news in the next few months.
That's James Fallows. He's national correspondent with The Atlantic, and he joins us here most Saturdays. You can read his blog at jamesfallows.theatlantic.com. Jim, thank you so much.
Thank you, Guy.
Now, long before NATO was even a glimmer, came the greatest American naval disaster you've never heard of, and it happened in the summer of 1779 in a place called Penobscot Bay. It's in present-day Maine, but at the time, the land was owned by Massachusetts. The American Revolution, which was still seen by the British as a rebellion, had just entered its third year.
And suddenly in the middle of this summer, the British send a very small expedition to land in the Penobscot Bay.
That's historical novelist Bernard Cornwell, and he picks the story up from there.
They intend to establish the province of New Ireland and to sort of hold the coast for Britain. It's really quite a small expedition that the British send, and the Massachusetts, quite rightly, decides they'll get rid of them.
But this is an act of war.
Yes, it's an act of war. And Massachusetts is going to send a fleet. In fact, it's the largest fleet ever assembled by the rebels in the whole War of Independence. Their orders said that you are to captivate, kill, or destroy the enemy.
Right.
Captivate, I love. So they were sent to captivate, kill, or destroy Francis Maclean and his 700 men. What happened was that this huge American fleet reached Penobscot Bay July the 28th in 1779, and the Americans attacked, and it was a very, very successful attack. They got their whole army ashore. The bluff was defended by a much smaller British picket. British had the advantage of the height. Four Americans had to climb this bluff, couldn't use their muskets. They needed both hands to pull themselves up the bluff. Drove the British off the top, and then when they'd gained the high ground and there in front of them was the fort, they inexplicably stopped. And at that point, everything goes wrong. The commander of the army, who's a man called Solomon Lovell, says, well, I can't attack the fort unless the three ships are destroyed. Commodore Dudley Saltonstall, who commanded the American fleet, said, well, I can't attack the fleet unless you attack the fort. Well, I can't attack the fort. Well, I can't attack the fleet. Well, I can't attack. And neither would move. I mean, you have this completely ludicrous situation where the general is saying, I'll move when the admiral moves, and the admiral is saying, I'll move when the general moves, and in the end, neither of them are talking to each other. It's this sort of horrible situation of watching a great ambition being destroyed by, I suppose, really just sheer incompetence.
So Bernard Cornwell, whose new book, by the way, takes place against the backdrop of Penobscot, Cornwell says that while the Americans were doing nothing, relying on a siege to starve out the redcoats, the British were building up a fort.
Making the walls of the fort higher and higher, getting more and more guns ashore.
The Americans eventually got wind of the fort, and they called in reinforcements. But it was too late. The British had already called in their own reinforcements.
And then suddenly the British relief fleet arrives in the river. At which point Saltonstall, who commanded the American fleet, well, I think the only word to say is he panics. They manage to get the whole army off the land onto the transport ships. When they get up the river, they're trapped and they can't get out because the British have blocked it. And the whole fleet is burned and went to the bottom of the river.
It was a massive loss. 41 ships sunk, the worst naval disaster in American history up until Pearl Harbor. But what's even more extraordinary, says Bernard Cornwell, is who was held partially responsible. He was the American officer in charge of artillery at Penobscot, but you may know him better from this poem.
Listen, my children, and hear
the midnight ride, Paul Revere, Paul Revere.
And I guess we have to cut a very long story short and say that at the end of the campaign, Paul Revere is going to be court-martialed for incompetence and for behavior tending towards cowardice.
Unbelievable. The hero.
It is unbelievable. Yes. And it struck me when I came across this. I mean, I
after Revere died in 1818, he might have been forgotten to history, if not for the poem Paul Revere's Ride. The poem was written by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow more than 80 years later, and it was largely fictional.
It's instantly famous. And Revere is suddenly sort of elevated into the great pantheon of American heroes.
Bernard Cornwell, this is not a widely known story. I mean, students in high school, even in universities, don't know about this. So, you know, why did you want to sort of deflate our balloon? You know, why did you want to pop our balloon?
Oh, I'm sorry. Guy, I'm not trying to deflate your balloon. I think I wanted to deflate Paul Revere's balloon. There's a supreme irony here. Henry Longfellow made him famous, and Henry Longfellow's name is Henry Wadsworth Longfellow.
Right.
And Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's grandfather was Peleg Wadsworth, the man who brought the most serious charges against Revere that got him court-martialed. And I do believe that Peleg Wadsworth is probably turning in his grave when he sees what his grandson did.
That's novelist Bernard Cornwell. His new book is called The Fort. Bernard Cornwell, thank you so much.
Thank you, Guy.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Begin this hour looking at the state of healthcare overhaul. Department of Health and Human Services on Monday is expected to announce rules that will specify exactly how much of each dollar insurance companies must spend on medical care and how much can be used for administrative expenses and profit. It's the latest in a long string of efforts to try to roll out the new health care law. But many newly elected Republicans heading to Congress list repealing that legislation as a top priority, or at least laying the groundwork for repeal. Here's current Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell speaking on Fox News earlier this month.
Our first goal is to repeal it and replace it, and if we have the votes to put it on his desk, we're going to do that.
But while many Republican voters may be all in favor of repealing the health law, it turns out there are a lot of other traditional Republican backers who are not. And Press Julie Rovner has been taking the temperature of the health care industry. She joins us now. Julie, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
So can you say who exactly is not in favor of repeal within the health care industry?
Well, it's most of the big players, hospital groups, a lot of doctor groups, drug makers, employers, even health insurers, which is not to say that they all love the law or that they don't want to see changes made. But some of them, particularly health insurers, are agitating for bigger changes than others. But almost without exception, they say they'd rather work to make changes to this law than scrap it and start over.
Now, trying to reduce the amount of regulation is a traditional Republican business-oriented issue. So why are some of these companies and interests, for the moment, siding with the Democratic initiative?
It's really about their own economic survival. You know, basically for everybody in the healthcare industry, if people don't have health insurance, they can't afford to buy healthcare services. So everybody was almost faced with going out of business. Plus, I think it's a little bit late to say that you don't want the government involved in healthcare when the government is already pretty much paying half of the nation's healthcare bill. So in a lot of ways, this was really the healthcare industry negotiating the terms of its surrender. And a lot of the industry got some pretty nice terms, starting with at least 32 million more paying customers who will be able to buy a lot more healthcare.
There are going to be some in the healthcare industry who are nevertheless dismayed by increased regulations and other reservations and support repeal.
Absolutely. You know, when you're redistributing 17% of the nation's economy, there's going to be winners and losers. I think one group that's very upset right now are health insurance brokers, the people who used to help individuals buy insurance. They're worried that when these new exchanges, these marketplaces come online, they won't have anything to do. There are still a lot of small business groups that are very much agitating for repeal, despite the fact that there's a lot in this law that's supposed to make insurance less expensive for small business, these groups, I think, are really still strongly ideologically with the Republicans in favor of repeal.
Near as you can tell, Julie, will this apparent hesitation to repeal the law on behalf of some major health care interest in any way tamp down the resolve that Republicans in Congress have to move forward with repeal?
Well, you know, it's been a big electoral issue for Republicans. They see it in their voting base being very strong. On the other hand, you know, a lot of these are big donors for Republicans. And a lot of these groups are, they're going to come to Congress and say, we really want to make changes in the law. We don't necessarily want to see the law repealed. So it's going to be a push and pull for a lot of Republicans. There could be legislation to make some changes that a lot of Democrats would agree to. No one suggested this law was going to be fixed in stone. We could end up seeing a split among Republicans, some who would be willing to make some changes and some who really want to push this repeal rock down the road, if you will, in anticipation of 2012. So we're really going to have to just watch and see what happens.
NPR's Julie Rovner, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.